Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, good evening. It's David Ewing with the We the People show on Blog Talk Radio. It's blogtalkradio.com/WTP-Texas for We the People Texas. It was originally a Texas show, and now it's a national show. And tonight we're going to have Gary Hunt with the Outpost of Freedom talking about a petition for redress of grievances he wrote titled Under One Banner. His web address is outpost-of-freedom.com/you-have-tread-on-me. All right. Good evening, Gary.
Good evening, David.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in doing this petition thing.
Well, about myself, goes back to about late 1992. Actually, it goes before then, but I became more active when I started publishing a newspaper out of Castleberry, Florida, called Outpost of Freedom. After the second edition was published, I received a phone call and ended up in Waco, Texas, for from March 5th to April 21st. And began using fax networks to get information out to people, thanks to Ken Varden in Las Vegas with American Patriot Fax Network. Went back to Florida after that and had so many requests to come and speak to people that I gave up my survey business and started traveling around the country talking about Waco and investigating other stories, for example, the murder of Michael Hill, the militia chaplain in Ohio and Oklahoma City, and a couple of Indian incidents up in New England country.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, about 96, I had to settle down and went back to work in Phoenix, Arizona, surveying again, and have continued writing on outpostoffreedom.com. But that writing slowed down over the years because the motivation that had existed in the mid-90s had died down. Now, when the economy started to go south just a few months ago, or quite a few months ago, I realized that one of the elements that we realized was necessary for enough people to become disenchanted with the activity of government had occurred, and so I began writing again. More recently, I wrote an article, Unlike Any Other Government, which is accessible on the main page at outpostoffreedom.com.
Okay.
And followed that with one called Divide and Conquer, which is what I saw happening to the community. There's a thousand tentacles to what we're trying to achieve, and Divide and Conquer addressed some of those tentacles and basically ask what is the consequence if, for example, somebody can prove that Obama was born in Kenya.
Yeah.
What's going to change?
Right. And, he's already elected. They should have took care of that before.
Right, and even if he was expelled from office, I guess Congress would have three choices. We would either have Joe Biden, which would be almost as bad as having Gibbs as the president, or we would have John McCain, or it could be thrown back into the House of Representatives as happened with Thomas Jefferson, since the president would not have been elected. So it gets rather confusing, and you don't know sometimes. Well, the monkey's paw, a very old story about you wishing and getting what you asked for, but the consequences that come with that request can be sometimes far worse than not having asked at all.
Right.
But the bottom line is Congress, for decades, has failed to do their job in accordance with the Constitution. So after I wrote Divide and Conquer, it occurred to me that redress of grievance is a guarantee in the Constitution. It's a provision in Article 1 of the Bill of Rights, and that a petition for redress of grievances needs to be submitted to Congress. And so in the petition itself, it actually gives the historical documentation, which provides support for the submission of the grievance to Congress. It acknowledges the Constitution and its support for submitting the petition of redress of grievances. And then it goes on to enumerate, I think, 33 items that if addressed by Congress, would solve nearly all of the problems that are those tentacles in the area of concern of the patriot or constitutionalist community. Mm-hmm. If Congress acted positively on those, we would, for all intents and purposes, do away with the power of political parties. It wouldn't do away with the parties. I mean, the right to association always exists, but their ability to influence elections both by the entry gate, who gets to go on the ballot, and their ability to fund candidates of their choice would disappear. There are a number of other areas in the petition that would weaken Congress and put them back in place and where they were intended to be by the Constitution.
Okay.
And that if they don't, then we go back to understand that they have ceased to represent us, which is what the colonists said back in the 1875
sure.
Olive Branch Petition.
Right.
They were seeking the rights of Englishmen under the English Constitution. Now, you understand the English Constitution was not written. It was rather historical, but through the years from the Magna Carta on, certain rights continued to be guaranteed to the people. Though unwritten, the colonists in America felt, rightfully so, that they should be treated as British subjects, just like the people in England, but they were not. And it wasn't just taxation. There were a number of issues, and they were listed in the Declaration of Independence. And we're in the same position today as they were then, that we have a written constitution, and it's being ignored by the government. And so this redress of grievances is to address to the Congress the shortcomings that we perceive in their current activities.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's kind of what we the people's already done. I mean, they've already taken a lawsuit, you know, based on Article 1, the redress of grievances, and been to the Supreme Court, and they just ignore it, you know.
Well, I realize they're not the first ones to attempt to go through the courts with the redress of grievances, but Article 1 doesn't say through the court. It guarantees that right. And so my feeling was that we needed to go directly to Congress, not with an electronic petition, because an electronic petition, somebody could write a computer program and add 10,000 names in 10 minutes.
Sure.
But to have pieces of paper with signatures, counties, and states on them, and have them stack up on the desk of the representatives to physically demonstrate how many people were involved in this. And, yes, I've looked around to see what other petitions have existed, but I think I tried to write this more consistent with what the Founding Fathers did with the Olive Branch petition and submit it directly to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, the others have not been very successful. It's very possible.
Well, I mean, we've been to Congress. In fact, Congress even agreed to meet with us, different representatives. They all reneged on that. See? So then we filed a petition, went all the way to the Supreme Court with it, and had approximately 1,500 named plaintiffs on that petition. So it wasn't some shot in the dark. It was a real petition, a lot of people on it, and basically, like I say, they just ignored it. Kicked it back out and said, "Well, we don't care about all those people that want us to do something. We're not going to do anything." You know, I think, you were mentioning about the government, whether they work for us or not. I think they've already proven they don't. Specifically during the first bailout, if you recall, the $700 billion bailout, they came on national TV. It was reported on national TV that 98% of the phone calls, faxes, and emails coming into Congress about the first bailout, they were saying they didn't want it. Okay, so what happened? They turned around and added $100 billion to it and went ahead and passed it. So that pretty much proved up the point right there that they don't work for us, they work for Wall Street. I mean, otherwise they'd have done what we wanted them to do.
Remember, the Olive Branch petition came after Lexington and Concord, after Bunker Hill, after the Battle of New York. It came when battle had already begun. Blood was being let. Lives were being lost. But it was a last effort to find a peaceful solution to the discrepancies in what the relationship between the colonists and England Parliament was. It, too, was addressed to Parliament, not even to the king, and it was the final notice. Now, whether this petition will serve as the final notice or not is yet to be seen.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The 17th of there's two big events coming up. September 11th, there are some large demonstrations planned and intended, and on the 12th there are some more, and then on the 17th of September is what is referred to as Constitution Day. It was the day that the Constitution was ratified, and that should be sufficient time. Now, if Congress does not come out, and let me be quite frank with this, I don't expect that they will do any more with this than they did with your petitions.
Right.
I would like to see tens or hundreds of thousands of people submit this petition so that they're vested in this
right.
plea to Congress or this set of demands to go back to the Constitution and operate
right.
in the capacity that they were hired to operate in. Remember,
exactly.
the Constitution created the government. It was a contract, and the government accepted that contract by establishing itself under the authority of the people. If they breached that contract, what happens if you breach a contract in civil life? The contract, you can demand specific performance, which
right.
is what we're demanding with the petition for redress of grievances, or you void the contract.
Right. Well, sure, and I think they've proven a long time the contract's been voided. Listen, I just want to make a note that we do have a number of callers online and some people in the chat room. If you're in the chat room, just go ahead and put your question up there, and I'll get it to Gary at first opportunity. And also, if you're, we'll get to the callers here in just a minute, and we'll give you a chance to ask your questions or comments. Yeah, well, so where do you think we're at with this right now? I mean, do you have any gauge on that?
Well, I have no way. I'm not a good programmer. I was years ago when I worked with DOS, but that was just to get the computer to do my survey work for me. And
sure.
so my web page is basic. It's an old-fashioned HTML page where you can put pages up and links up, put pictures in. I was thinking of trying to come up with some way of counting what was happening, but I'm just not sophisticated enough. Now, this understand that the petition has no organization behind it. It has no funding behind it. It has no leadership. Its full intention is to be absolutely grassroots.
Okay.
It will live or die depending on what each of us does with our version of the petition. We send it on to other people. We sign our three copies and give them the representative and two senators that are supposed to represent us, or we don't. And so I have no way of counting except to know that I've received a lot of emails. If I count the emails in support of it, we don't have enough to break 100. But I'd like to think that, well, let's go back to the Fax Network in Waco. When Ken Varden set up the Fax Network, which was before Waco, and he contacted me, and I was putting out press releases to about 20 people that were on my fax network. Ken said, I need a fax every night, and we'll put it out overnight. He had five fax machines. He was faxing out initially to 600 people, and I think he got up to about 1,500 by the time Waco was over, and we expected that each one of those would refax to at least 10 people. So we were getting out to perhaps 15,000 people. Now, I'd like to think that this is working the same way, but I have no way of gauging that.
Right.
I think we'll gauge it more by watching CNN and CBS and NBC on the 12th and see if there are a lot of people waving a piece of paper with a little yellow rectangle, bright yellow rectangle in the top center of the paper. I doubt that the congressmen are going to be honest about it, but there is no way at this point to gauge how many have been turned in, unless people email me at the link at the bottom of the petition page or either of the pages.
They, you know, they turn theirs in.
Know.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we take a question now? Or?
Yeah, let's go ahead and call us. Listen, what I'm going to do on the callers is call out your last four digits of your phone number. Now, the first caller, I'm going to call them in order, is actually a Skype caller. So if you're a Skype caller, I can't tell your phone number, so just go ahead and speak up. Skype caller, do you have a question for Gary? Okay, well, it may not be Skype. It may be something else, but it's not a phone.
Is that the SIR?
Yeah, it just gives me all zeros, so I don't know what it is.
Oh, okay.
All right, well, they didn't come on, so let's go to the next one. Your last four digits of your phone number is 8430. Do you have any questions for Gary?
Oh, hi, Gary.
Yes.
Yeah, this is Keith Broders.
Oh, Keith, how are you?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. I really applaud you for your efforts, and I really didn't have a question. I didn't realize that I had pushed the button to have a question for you, but
I'm just calling out callers that are on, you know, the people that called in, just see if they're
coming.
Well, understand, Keith and I have been in communication for a few months now, and Keith, I think, has learned a lot. He is relatively new, but he's very astute and he listens very carefully. I was hoping he could come up with a question.
Yeah, you're here now. I mean, come on.
Well, like I said, you kind of caught me off guard. I think that it's really important, obviously, that we hold our elected officials accountable. We are in a terrible situation, but we also have to accept the responsibility for that, because obviously we're the ones who elected these clowns, and we're the ones who keep reelecting these clowns. And so basically, as we sow, so shall we reap.
Well, why don't we talk about that for a minute? Because how do we get, sucked into electing clowns, you know?
Well, let me explain a little bit about Keith. Keith is trying very hard in the Southern California area to get copies of the Constitution, pocket copies of the Constitution, into the hands of school kids, because the schools are deficient in educating children on the Constitution. In fact, I doubt they even have the opportunity to read the whole thing. And he's being pushed back by the school districts, because most pocketbooks on the Constitution will have at least one or two religious references in it, and that's, from what I understand, been the excuse that they've turned things around. Mm-hmm. But as far as kicking people out, back in the 90s after Waco, there was a fellow in Tampa, Florida, that was trying to kick them all out, or nobody goes back. I don't remember what he called his campaign. I met with him a few times, and he was optimistic that he would be successful. As I traveled around the country, I talked with people about that, and they say, yeah, we ought to kick everybody out except, and I'm going to use a good example. When I was in Las Vegas, Nevada, except Harry Reid, because he's good. He's looking out for our state. Now, I'm sure they've all reconsidered their position about Harry Reid now, but they, everywhere I went, people felt their congressman was good because he was bringing money to the state.
Right.
And then if we go a little further, look at the people on the public dole. They're not going to vote for somebody that would stop that handout of free money, stealing from us and giving to them.
Sure.
So I think that the electoral system has been so manipulated over the years that they have pretty much guaranteed that between the two parties, at least, the parties will pick who gets elected. Now, you might have a choice, but is there any real difference between the parties?
Right.
So
exactly.
The practicality of kicking them all out, I think, is nearly non-existent.
Right.
I would like to mention that the Rasmussen poll recently indicated that 57% of the American populace that participated in the Rasmussen poll all agreed that they wanted to see Congress, all of Congress, basically kicked out. The 57% was the total, and I think they said that there was something like 19% were uncertain or something. But so anyway, there's a tremendous amount of people right now that have reached the boiling point.
Well, as I said, back in the 90s, everybody was willing to get rid of every other congressman. Now, the problem is that poll does not give us an answer of whether they want to get rid of their representative and their senators. 57%, I mean, we'd have to approach 94% to have even get a balance against getting rid of your three representatives in Congress. And, you know, it might work. It might be that now there's enough concern over it, but how long do we wait to find out? If it doesn't happen in 2010, do we go to 12? Do we go to 14? Do we go to 16? And when do we finally say, it ain't going to work? So
well,
I'm going to assume, based on, you know, the last decade, that it probably won't. At least that's my personal opinion. It's not going to work.
Well, I feel that one of the things is that right now the people in Congress, they know that they can continue to do business as normal, and they, 95% of the time the incumbent is going to get reelected. They have no incentive or no reason, basically, to listen to their constituents. They have a choice. Do we listen to the constituents and forfeit all of the funds that we would get from the special interest groups on Wall Street? And what they end up doing is they say, well, look, let's just take the money from Wall Street and let the constituents, let's just ignore them, give them a bunch of lip service, and continue to ignore them. Well, I don't think the American people are buying that anymore. And if, frankly, if we don't succeed and get 100% turnaround in Congress, we don't need it. But if we can vote out 30 to 40% of the incumbents, we'll send a loud and clear message to Washington. And those people who survive are now going to have to make a choice. They're going to have to realize that, you know, the odds of getting reelected just dropped from 95% to 40%. And if I'm going to get reelected, rather than listen to Wall Street, maybe I ought to listen to my constituents.
Well, I agree, and it would be nice to see that happen. But, Keith, you've read the petition. What do you think? If Congress accepted the petition and did what they said, wouldn't we solve that problem instantly?
I suspect that that's the case, but I just don't have much faith in Congress. I think, basically, if we got rid of the incumbents, we had a bunch of new people in there, I think they'd be a lot more likely to go along with the petition than a bunch of these old-timers that have been around since the Pleistocene era.
Okay, well, let's look at it from a little different approach, Keith. I'm asking you directly. What benchmark do we use to determine whether that will be a successful means or not? Will it be the 2010 elections? And if so, what is the benchmark? What do we have to see? I think
as far as turnover is concerned?
Yes.
You know, I really haven't thought about it exactly, but I think that frankly, I would say that if we can replace 50% or more of the people in Congress, then I would say that would probably be a very, very good sign.
Okay, now let's suppose then that we only turn over 25 or 30%. Where do we go from there?
Well, you know,
I hate to put you on the spot.
No. The problems that we have today did not happen during a 2 or 4 or 6 year term. It's happened over the last 100 years, and for us to expect to be able to give Congress an enema and clean it all out in one fell swoop is probably very ambitious. I think that if we could get 25% or so in 2010, and then in 2012, if we could vote out another 25%, maybe in a period of 6 years, we could have, I'd say maybe in 6 years we could turn over Congress.
But if not, at the rate they're going, what? Assume nothing's done. In 6 years, how bad off will we be? And you're right, it goes back really to, as far as I'm concerned, it goes to the beginning of the Civil War.
Yes.
But the progression has become so rapid lately from, say, 1993 to 2009, the last 13 years has been a very rapid rate of diminishment of our rights.
And that's why we don't have 100 years to fix the problem.
Well, even if you got a new Congress, say you got 49%, you still don't have enough in Congress to even begin to turn it unless you put the fear of God in those people that were in Congress.
And that's where your petition, the one part of your petition in particular that I just absolutely love is the idea that if a congressman violates their oath of office, that the people in the district can hold them accountable by having the individual taken before the citizens' grand jury, and that person essentially could be tried and thrown in jail for violating his oath of office.
Well, that is why the petition's out there. If they ignore the petition, though, then that is a moot point, and that's...
Well, and you said if they violate their oath of office, they've been violating their oath of office for years. Come on, they just stole $2 trillion from us. How much violation of their oath do we need to?
And that's why, frankly, I don't think it'll be difficult to get the number of signatures necessary to convene a grand jury to try and to indict.
Violations. They all need to be in jail.
Well, there's nothing there. They have an ethics committee now, but the petition, David, does have a provision for a federal citizens grand jury that would be created by the Congress under the authority granted them for inferior courts by the Constitution,
right.
And, but would also preclude that the petite jury that heard the case from being reviewed by any other court, which I believe they have the authority to. And there are other provisions that require that if he receives any gift, favor, benefit, money, anything from anybody to try and influence his vote, that he immediately go before the Ethics Committee. If the Ethics Committee determines that that is a fact, that he's immediately discharged from his office. So there are provisions put in there in every way that I could think of to try and curtail the course that the Congress has been pursuing for so long.
Right.
But, you know, Keith, I appreciate your optimism. When you've been here 13 years like I have, I think that your optimism, if we live that long, your optimism will be much reduced. I'd like to see it happen, but we'll just have to wait and see. Thank you for calling in, Keith. Okay, do we have another caller, or shall we go to...
Yeah, we can try our Skype caller again. Skype caller, I don't know what your number is, but go ahead and speak up. We'll give them a second here because they might be a little slow if they're on their...
is there anybody on a Skype call or an internet phone call?
Internet phone, Skype, shoe phone, whatever they want to call it, yeah. All right, you're online if you want to speak up. Skype caller. And they have their hand up. They can. I think you can press, it should tell you when you call in, press number one or something. It'll
give you
a little hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's go on to the next one then.
Yeah, well, that's all we got. The other one already dropped off while we were talking.
Well, we've got a few comments on the chat.
Yeah, we got quite a few in the chat here. I was just kind of looking through all this.
Well, I don't want to talk about Barney Frank. That has nothing to do with the petition. So let's go on down. And the ballot box, not the cartridge box, is the only constitutional power / force the people have over government. That came from Alan Hampton. Let me address that. Alan, I presume you have read the petition, and if you wanted more extensive understanding of the authority granted by the founders to us to deal with the problem, read Unlike Any Other Government. But there is no doubt that the Declaration of Independence is as much a part of the founding documents of this country as is the Constitution. The Constitution was a consequence of the Declaration of Independence. It does not stand alone. It exists only because the Declaration was signed. Now, the Declaration of Independence does three things. It explains what the purpose of government is. It explains the relationship of the government to the people. And finally, it explains what to do when government fails to do its job. So I'm not making anything up. I'm not saying that we should take the third course unless we feel it's necessary. But John Locke wrote extensively on that, and it was from John Locke's writings that the Declaration of Independence got a lot of its thought and a lot of its method of presentation. But from the Declaration of Independence, very bluntly, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to effect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Now, let's back up just a little bit, because when I first started reading that, I said that it's right of the people to alter or abolish it. Now, there is no provision in the Constitution for us to alter government without the participation of the states and or the federal government. There is no provision in the Constitution for us to abolish that government. Therefore, Articles 9 and 10 of the Bill of Rights come into play, because the only way that we could possibly abolish that government is to recognize that it ceases to exist in its proper capacity and therefore no longer represents us. If you have some ideas that would indicate the error of my thinking on that, I would like to hear them. Let's see, comments from Alan. The Constitution does not endorse armed revolution. That is absolutely correct. And as long as there's not a breach of contract by government, everything's fine. But when that is breached, which is exactly what happened to the colonists back in 1765 on, there were constant breaches in the Constitution.
Right.
The British Constitution. So they wrote the Declaration of Independence. And that set forth the necessity to declare their independence from England. Now, I'm not suggesting we declare independence from the United States of America. I'm suggesting that we restore it. Now, you say we do not need an armed revolution. All we need is enforce the Constitution. Well, the government has usurped the authority away from the people by any number of means. Enforcing is done by the government with force. There's no alternative. A cop has a gun to pull on you and make you comply with his wishes. That's enforcing. The judge has his bailiffs that will throw you in jail. The BATF has their agents who will go in and shoot women and children in church to enforce the law. So enforcement, by its very nature, especially as defined by the United States government or the U.S. government, is force. Now, if they can use force, where did they get that right?
Right.
They can only have rights that we gave to them.
That's right.
So if we gave them
the
right
privileges. They don't have rights.
Well, if they have the privilege of using force, it can only be their privilege because we gave it to them.
Exactly.
Now, can we give them something that we have not ourselves?
That's the whole concept right there. The created cannot be greater than the creator. That's a basic maxim of law since the beginning of time. So you're right. We can't give them something that we don't already possess ourselves.
Yes, they're just acting in a collective capacity with the rights that we have. But
right.
Usurpation is taking powers that don't exist. And usurpation was what the British Parliament and the King had done, taking powers that did not exist
well,
by overriding the unwritten British Constitution.
Sure, and that's what they're doing now. I mean, actually, they've been doing it, but it's just that now people are waking up for it. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. It started very noticeably after the Civil War.
Yes,
before it really started.
Actually, you know, my benchmark is there was one point in our history. There were questionable areas, Alien Sedition Act and a number of the other activities
sure.
that occurred early on, but there's
right.
one very pronounced violation of the Constitution that has always bothered me, and it occurred in 1860 or 61. Congress recognized West Virginia as a member of the Union. They did so without the consent of Virginia. Now, the Constitution very specifically says that a state can be made, new states, Article 4, Section 3, new states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned, as well as of the Congress. Now, you know, when you're researching something, you can't tell that you looked everywhere. But I have looked everywhere I could think of, and I have never found any acknowledgement by the state of Virginia that would allow Congress to create West Virginia out of portions of Virginia. So a very blatant, outright violation of the Constitution, which was done to get a quorum in Congress.
Right.
They achieved in getting the quorum. But at that point, as far as I'm concerned, they drastically walked away from the authority granted by the Constitution.
I agree.
So we go back 149 years, roughly, to blatant violations of the Constitution.
Right.
So, Alan, I think we can keep going. Alan says he agrees with the petition. I'm glad to hear that. Alan, just a question for you then. If the petition, say we have 2 or 3 million people sign that petition and submit it to Congress, and the Congress refuses to even acknowledge the petition, the redress of grievances that we've offered to them, what would you propose? Type fast, because we don't want to have too much dead time on the air here. But we've got a dilemma, and we talked with Keith about the same thing. What is the benchmark? At what point do we either accept absolute subjugation to government, or do we defy government by whatever means necessary? That's the real question. What are the benchmarks? At what point have they crossed the line? Vote them out. Now, we just discussed vote them out, Alan. Give me a benchmark. You heard me talking with Keith about it, I assume. If in 2010 we've got, say, 40% of them out, is that sufficient? Is that going to change things when you've got 60% incumbents? Well, if we have the fear of God in the other 60%, perhaps, but everything I've seen in my observations of government is you cannot put the fear of God in those people. So 10% is a good first step in 2010. That's from Alan. At that rate, Alan, it would be, let's see, two-year increments, 2030, before we would have 100%. It would be 20-something. Even 2% is better than none. Nothing is better than the majority, Alan. Look at the rate we're going. Alan said even 2% is better than none. Yes, it is, but it will not stop the flow of usurpation, the flow of abuse of authority. It's just not going to happen.
Well, let's go on. We got a couple new callers now, so let's go ahead.
Yeah, let's go with the caller.
Yeah, let's go ahead and pick up on the calls now. I got a Skype caller again. This might be a new one, but if you can hear us, go ahead and start talking. Skype caller, shoe phone, something, internet caller.
Skype, you've been on the air for quite a while. Are you there?
Hello.
Hello.
Yep. Hello.
We hear you.
Hello.
Yep. Go ahead. We hear you.
Okay. Gary, this is Marty Oakley with the PPJ Gazette.
Marty,
hi. I just signed you onto my site. Hi.
Yes.
I wanted to back up just a little bit here in your conversation. I've been sitting here listening and waiting in queue, and you were talking about enforcement. And one of the ways that they accomplished this is through the 1946 Administrative Procedures Act, and this is when they started actually assembling the statutes and codes, which are civil laws and are not the common laws of the Constitution, and this is part of the puzzle of how they get away with what they're doing. They created all these unelected bureaucracies. They pass bills that simply establish one agency after another and then give them the authority to rulemake, which is actually lawmaking, avoiding the Congress. And they give them the right of enforcement. And fully 55% of every dime spent by the federal government on all of these programs they put out there and all these, and I don't care which administration, which party, is spent on enforcement. And that is using the government to force the people to meet the requirements of whatever that law or program is. And so somewhere along the line, we have got to go back. You talked about earlier the changes in 1913 and the creation of the Federal Reserve. This what's coming into play has been a long time coming. And it has accelerated in the last 8 years under Bush 2. And now that we are in what I consider to be the third term of Bush, we are
forward.
Going to see. Excuse me?
Fast forward now?
We're being fast forwarded up to this time and being pushed to the final end. I think we're very close to the hammer being dropped and everything being turned over and this whole thing exposed. And by exposed, I mean they're just going to come out and blatantly take everything from us. We've heard conversation about the Constitution being irrelevant, that it no longer applies, that you can't apply it to these days and times because of all these threats from terrorists. And my personal and final opinion on this is the terrorists we need to fear as a nation are all sitting in a seat in Washington, D.C.
There you go.
And that's my opinion. That's all I have to say. It was good to talk to you, Gary.
You too, Marty. Let me give a little plug for Marty. She is really... I sent her a copy of Under One Banner, and she got back with me almost immediately. Marty has a page, ppjg.wordpress.com, and she jumped right on this. And I think one thing that really, based on what she just said, one thing that really struck her eye on this is one provision in the petition that says, that all administrative agencies of government shall be stripped of rulemaking authority, that all rules enforced by any such agency shall henceforth be created directly and specifically by an enactment of the Congress and passed into law as prescribed by the Constitution. Now, interestingly, too, I've got a number of people that have challenged, why didn't you include the Second Amendment in this? We need the Second Amendment. Well, most of the enforcement by BATF is based on the rules promulgated by the BATF, as Marty just explained. And there is another provision that Congress shall cite constitutional authority for any enactment that they do. Now, the rules have been enacted without any constitutional oversight at all. We question some of the enactments as constitutional or not, but to understand... Well, let me go back to Waco. When I did a little investigation when I was in Waco to find out if Janet Rito could turn things around, the way it works with administrative agencies, and the Justice Department is one of those, that Bill Clinton could ask Janet Reno to, and insist that Janet Reno withdraw the troops from Waco. And Janet Rito could say no. And Bill Clinton's only option at that point, surprisingly, because of the power of administrative rules, would be to fire Janet Reno and replace her with somebody that would call the forces of evil off of the church in Waco, Texas. That Bill Clinton did not have the authority under the rules to stop what was happening in Waco. He could only request it. That's how bad the administrative agencies have come into power. And that's the greatest usurpation. Now, in talking with people about administrative agencies, one of the most fascinating Supreme Court cases I've ever run across is called Ashwander versus TVA. A fascinating case because Justice Brandeis, in a concurring opinion, pointed out the 9 points that the Supreme Court used to evaluate whether they would rule on the constitutionality of any case brought before them. And the absolute last resort was ruling on constitutionality. They would rule, anybody who seeks a benefit from an administrative agency, for example, is subject to the rules of that agency. Therefore, if you're in any way related with a government administrative agency, the rules of the agency supersede the Constitution. They put the Constitution aside, and if they can rule under the administrative agency rules, they will. To heck with the Constitution.
Yeah.
And so we wonder why the Supreme Court decisions don't appear to be consistent with the Constitution when, in fact, in 1937 in Ashwander versus TVA, they explained to us that they're not going to rule on the constitutionality unless they have no other recourse. So she's absolutely right. The food, the codex, I can't think of the other word that goes with it, the chemicals they put in our food, the new stuff they put in cigarettes that makes them go out and makes them all taste the same and makes me want to quit smoking. The flush toilets, the 1.2 gallon or whatever it is, where you flush it five times to finally get it to flush and use more water than you used to. These are administrative agency rules. Some idiot, well paid with your money, sits up there, talks to his friends, maybe in the porcelain industry, and says, we need a flush toilet that uses less water. They don't do any study, but they impose that law on us, and now you're stuck with it. The Internal Revenue Service, over 20 million words. There's 4,000 words in the Constitution about. There's 20 million words in the tax code. Most of the tax code is administrative agency rules.
Right.
So if this...
Well, and it's, again, it's a law that people can't understand. Supposedly, if the law is written in such a way that the normal people that live in the country can't understand it, then it's not valid anyway.
That's true, and I think it was Alexander Hamilton said, how can that be a law which is little understood and constantly changing? And the tax code changes every year, and with 20 million words, I don't think anybody's ever read the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
but, you know, hey,
we've got to turn it.
Caller we never did get to. Let's get to this last caller. I'm gonna, maybe not. Sorry.
Do we have a caller on there?
Well, we did.
Yeah.
All right. Some people just don't want to talk. Might have waited a little bit too long. Not everybody's got long distance. I like to get them on as soon as I can anyway. Cause
well,
you never know.
The calling queue is open if anybody wants to call in.
Yeah, we've got quite a few in the chat if anybody wants to call and do their comments. I'm watching the board. I understand all these things. What it really comes down to, like you mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, it said the people. Now, when it's talking about the people, what is it saying exactly? You know, because here again, the created cannot be greater than the creator. It was the people themselves that created the governments, local and then on up the line. And another little thing about the Supreme Court there. Where was the Supreme Court created from? Who created the Supreme Court? Did the federal government create the state government, or did the state government create the federal government?
The state governments collectively, first nine states ratified it, created ratified the Constitution and brought it into existence.
Right.
They did
so
as representatives of the people, because for the first time in the history of the world, the source of power emanated from the people, not from God through his descendancy.
Let's look at that a little closer. If it was the states that created the federal government, then how could the Supreme Court be, over any of the state courts?
Well, the Supreme Court used to rule only on issues that were of federal significance, and the limitations on federal authority, I think, is very clear in the Constitution. Now, attorneys tell us that, well, they wrote it wrong. You know, that's why we can't have nativity scenes at Christmas on public land. They argue that these things don't mean what they do, but what's called the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which is presumed to give authority to the federal government to go wherever they want to go, is to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Now, if we take out foregoing, that's what they're doing. They're saying, well, we have all the powers necessary.
Right.
But what precedes that is Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which enumerates the powers. And if you go back and read Federalist Papers, even Alexander Hamilton, a man that I detest, said the limitations of the federal authority are enumerated in the Constitution. Well, that's fine. But now the attorneys and the courts are telling us that Alexander Hamilton was wrong. Just because he helped write it doesn't mean he knew what it was saying.
Right.
But the Supreme Court, for many years, acted only on issues that were consistent with that interpretation. Somewhere along the line, they started ruling beyond the scope. In fact, one of my favorite cases is the abortion case. What is it, Jane Doe?
Right.
Interestingly,
Roe versus Wade.
That's right. Roe versus Wade. Everybody's looking at that and saying, "Well, we want the federal government to change it." But if you read that, the dissenting opinion said, "For years we've gotten along just fine. Some states have laws against abortion, others don't. That's always been the purview of the states, and we are erring in expanding our authority into the realm that has traditionally belonged to the states." And that is in Roe versus Wade, dissenting opinion. He was absolutely right because Congress was going beyond its scope in dealing with moral laws, which are the role of the state or the county or the local government. There should be no moral laws under the Constitution.
Right.
Because morality is based on religion. It's hard to have morality.
They already admitted they overstepped and they're not following the Constitution. That's the whole point. A lot of these cases that you can go back and cite, we can already see that they've overstepped the Constitution. It hasn't been a Constitution in effect really since the Civil War. It's just that it's become now a little bit more obvious to people that we got problems. So now they're looking for solutions.
So the
real solution is our whole country's been dumbed down for so long. You know,
a number of us have known this. Some people go back 20, 30 years. When I got involved, there were a lot of people. It was hard to find them because they were scattered around the country. We didn't have the internet, but a lot of people were aware of all this. And you know, as time progresses, more people become involved. And more recently, the influx of people. For example, Keith Rodgers, the fellow that spoke called in first. Has only been a part of the Patriot community this year, but the expansion of government powers is beginning to encompass more and more people all the time. They're being affected directly by the abuses of power by the government, so our ranks are growing rapidly.
Well, that's why they have to step in here pretty soon and just take over completely. And they have to do that because if they don't, you know, like you say, things are going to grow, more people are going to get involved, and they're not going to be able to take over. So
they've
got to do what they got to do here pretty soon.
Well, that's the whole reason that I keep asking people for their benchmark. What is going to be an indicator? And 2%, 10%, 20%, even 40% is not going to be an indicator at that point in time that there's going to be a change in the attitude of government. It might be something to hope for. But we can hope ourselves to oblivion. We can hope ourselves into slavery.
I agree.
And I'm tired of hoping.
I agree.
Now, somebody, Jan Belupo, he's up in Canada. He's from California originally. And he asked, where was the legality of Waco? Well, it was interesting. In Waco, I got talking to an ATF agent at one point, and I said, what are you guys here for, really? You came to collect a tax on automatic rifles. Am I correct? And he says, yes. And I said, well, you really expect to collect that tax? And he says, oh, we will collect it. And I pointed out that, you know, the British tried to collect taxes at the point of a gun. Have we gone full circle? And he basically said, we'll do whatever we have to collect that tax. So he acknowledged that BATF under Treasury Department is the tax collection agency based on the rules promulgated by that agency and enforced by that agency and subject only to federal jurisdiction because, remember, the Davidians stood trial for defending their lives and their church, but the BATF never stood trial for the people to judge whether they violated the law. And so let's take a step back in history. There's something we're all aware of. It's called the Boston Massacre. I think there were 9 British soldiers involved. One of them was Captain Preston or Lieutenant Preston. He was an officer. The rest were enlisted men, corporals and privates. But they fired in self-defense, probably, as came out in the trial, fired and killed 5 people. They all stood trial. John Adams, one of the founding fathers, defended them in court. He got all but 2 acquitted because they acted in self-defense. The 2 that were not acquitted were convicted of manslaughter. Their sentence was death. They sought sanctity of the church, which means they had to read a verse in front of a priest or a minister, and then they were branded on the hand and released. That's how justice was served under the oppressive British system. The British representatives, British law enforcement, British soldiers could stand trial if there was a question of whether they acted within the law or not.
Right.
Somehow in this country, and we've got Waco, where there's a serious question whether they acted within law. There's even more serious question in an incident that happened a year before that up in Idaho when a 14-year-old boy was shot in the back, even though he had a rifle in his hand, and an unarmed mother holding her infant daughter was shot by a sniper to death. Mm-hmm. Now, the state of Idaho eventually came back with an indictment on manslaughter against Lon Haruishi. The federal government said, well, we'll pick up the case then, or I guess Haruishi petitioned the federal government saying, you know, I don't want to go to state court, I want to go to federal court. And so the federal courts picked it up, and then they looked at it and they said, there's no crime here, and dismissed it.
Right.
So we don't even have the safeguard of the judicial process to challenge whether acts were committed within the law when they're committed by government. And so we have people getting shot 86 times when they're unarmed. All these things happen over and over again in this country, and there's never any accountability.
Well, that's kind of what I was trying to point out before. We've already had so many violations now that, you know, most of the people in the federal government, except for very few, should have been put in jail years ago. And but people don't really, I'm not sure people don't really realize what's going on or not. I think they're watching too much TV or something.
Well, here's a follow-up question on Waco. Fellow citizen jurors convicted the survivors of Waco. Yes, they did, and I spoke with Sarah. Oh, what was her last name? Sarah. She was the jury foreman, and when I spoke with her, and I'm going to call the tactic a shotgun charge, she said they had lodged so many charges against these people that we felt we had to convict them of something. So we picked the one that had the least penalty for it, and that charge that they were convicted of was use of a firearm in commission of a crime. However, they were not convicted of a crime. So, as absurd as the judicial system has got, people in the jury, for the most part, believe that if you've got 9, 10, 11 charges against these people, they got to be guilty of something. That's the judicial shotgun. So we got to convict him of something. So then the jury says, okay, we'll find the lowest penalty, and we'll go with that one. And it doesn't make sense. It's like being arrested for resisting arrest. What was I being arrested for? Use of firearm in commission of a crime. What crime? They were not convicted of a crime, so how could they use the firearm in the commission of a crime? But the jury opted for the lowest one to satisfy what they felt is their obligation to convict because the federal government brought charges. And Sarah Bain was so upset over what happened, especially when the judge came back and added 15 years on a number of sentences because they used an automatic firearm, a rule, administrative agency rule, in the commission of that crime that did not exist.
Right.
And she was so upset, she wrote to the judge, she wrote to the a number of people, but the jury trial, they stood convicted, and some of them are out now, but they lost major portions of their lives. They were denied time with their families, with their children growing up. They were denied all these things that we expect, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, because the government went into Waco, into a church, and started shooting it up on a Sunday morning. Welcome to America. That is when I changed and gave up my business and decided to pursue going after the government.
Yeah,
now, let's
well,
see if we...
it's, you and me both, we probably didn't talk about that, but Waco's what set me off. I went to a, I guess it was the first showing of Rules of Engagement, Waco Rules of Engagement. I don't know if you saw that movie.
Yes.
I guess you did, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was in Austin, and I was living in Houston at the time, and we heard it's going to be out there. So me and some other guys all went out there to watch it. And I tell you what, that was the most moving thing. there were people, and most of the people in that movie were, you know, from the school. They got a big school in Austin. A lot of them were from there, and they came over to see it, and mostly younger people. And I swear, everybody that came out of that was just crying. That was just that emotional. It was so obvious to everyone there that the government killed those people. And
I like the term murder.
Well, okay. But that's what I meant to say. But,
yes.
You know, it was so obvious to everybody that, you know, everybody that came out of there, they were just crying about that whole thing. And you know, it was very emotional. And I just sighed right there. I mean, you know, it was very obvious that they machine gunned them down. You could see it on the video.
Yeah.
Don't tell me they didn't machine gun them down. You could see it right there, you know.
There's no doubt. In fact, when I went back after we finally got access to the property there, I had talked to some of the Davidians while they were still in custody, either in jail or in the halfway house, Salvation Army halfway house, and they were telling me about the sniper pits all over. Ron Cole and I walked around the property, and we got pictures of some of them. There were at least seven sandbag emplacements with firing platforms for snipers surrounding Mount Carmel Center. I'm sure some got destroyed with all the movement of destruction of evidence before the Texas Rangers were allowed on the scene to investigate the crime scene that they were assigned to investigate. But, you know, what can I say? I mean, I was in Waco, and I remember going out on the balcony and looking at that smoke rising in the distance, and I'd go back in and look at CNN and see that place on fire, and how could it have come to this in this country? Now, there is a follow-up question from Alan. He says, miscarriage of justice. Jurors are obligated to dispense justice. No, you don't dispense justice. The jurors traditionally have a right to determine both law and fact. It's called fully informed jury. If you're not sure of that, Alan, I suggest you go to, I think it's FIJA.com. You'll find the information. And historically, in this country, the jury has always been allowed to judge both law and fact to determine if the law is appropriate. And there are a number of cases. The Dred Scott decision, it was a result of jury nullifying the runaway slave laws. Prohibition was repealed because people refused to convict jurors or people charged with violating the 18th Amendment prohibition. So the tradition is longstanding in this country. But now the jurors are told, you've got to do this. In fact, now, last time I was on jury duty was a long time ago. But now apparently they're getting little check sheets. And if you get too many checks on this side, you've got to find them guilty. But the judge lies to the jury. He doesn't tell them they have a right to determine both fact and law.
I'm glad you said that, because I was just sitting here chomping at the bit to point pull that out. The judges lie. Every judge lies to the jury when they instruct the jury. And if you don't believe that, there's a set of books on instructing the jury instructions, federal and state jury instructions. Go look at the book.
Federal government has one specifically for tax cases too, which is rather interesting.
They got jury instructions, and every time they're instructed, they lie to them. Tell them, you have to rule this way or you have to rule that way. If you this or if you that, they could lie to them every time. And no wonder. And the people just eat it up. They have no knowledge whatsoever of what they're supposed to be doing as a juror. They don't know.
Well, they presume the authority of the federal government exists when they're told by the judge that it does.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. When I started studying law in with the intention of speaking for myself in court, one of the most important things I learned was not what is the law, but what are the rules of the court. Now, if you're ever going to go to court for anything in the jurisdiction you're in, and every federal district has rules, every state has rules, every county superior court has rules of the court for both civil and criminal, if you go into court and intend to fight a case, that if you don't have the rules of court, you're going to get screwed. There was
those rules anyway.
Pardon?
They don't follow them.
No, they don't. Not only if it suits them. But if you follow the rules, you can pretty much insist that that your rights be respected under the rules, even though the other side can break the rules. If I satisfy the rules in timeliness, they're bound to hear my motion, for example.
Right.
But the government can always get extensions of time to have their motion heard.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It's very important.
They don't follow the rules. The rules are there for you, not for them.
Right. But the rules of court prescribe what you can and can't do. And if you step out of the rules, they'll dismiss or they'll find in favor of the government strictly because you missed your point. And there was a series on years ago called The Paper Chase. It was about a law student. And that is the proper word for it. It is a paper chase, and you can shuffle paper. This benefits attorneys because the paper chase with something, if it went to court and was heard, might take 5-10 hours. In fact, takes hundreds of hours throwing paperwork, motions, and pleadings back and forth, back and forth. It fills the pockets of attorneys.
Yeah. Well, they create themselves a job, and the reason is because they control the court from bottom to top. You know, the whole bar runs everything. People don't understand, it's just there's extreme ignorance in this country about what's going on, how things are being done. I'm not sure we can do much about it at this point. People are just too ignorant. I mean, I don't know how to say it nicely. People
I think we need to submit our olive branch petition, our last effort for a peaceful solution to Congress, and I hope that hundreds of thousands or millions of people are willing to do so because they understand how bad things have gotten.
Yeah.
Allen did a follow-up. He was called to jury duty, and the federal judge's instructions were jurors dispense justice. Then judge instructions were he will give the jury the law. And, yeah, that's it. I mean, you guys are free to decide what you can, but I'm going to put the constraints on how you look at the case. If this happened, you have to find them guilty of this. If this happened, you have to find them guilty of that. And it's so fine line that you're a charade. Absolutely. You're just there to give the appearance of justice being administered is the word that justice is. It's not dispensed, but it's administered. And so that judge was wrong in saying dispensing. But he ties your hands, Alan, and I'm sure when you listened to him, you saw that he kept narrowing the bounds of your ability to even consider certain things to make the determination of innocence or guilt. But we'll leave that on and see if we've got somebody else. Waco trial was held in San Antonio, wasn't it, David?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yes.
Well, listen, let's check our two callers. They're still hanging
okay.
in. Let's go back to our Skype caller and see if we got any new questions from our Skype caller. That was your friend, the girl?
Yeah.
Hello.
Is that you again, Marty? Hello, Skype caller?
Yes.
So, but she's not talking.
Talking to me?
Are you there? Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not a Skype caller, and I just wondered what's going on.
Oh, okay, well, it just comes up as all one, so I didn't know. It's either like an internet call or a shoe phone or something.
Did you have a question?
Well, you were all over the place. You kind of formulated my questions now. I think that with the thousands or hundreds of thousands or possibly 3 million people that may get involved in this this movement that you were speaking about earlier, I think that the best thing to do is to go to the mechanisms that get these people in office in the first place. One of them is campaign finance. Now, right now, as you too well know, that if I ran for a Congress, I collect any donations from all over the country if I wanted to. And my question is, why should someone in California have anything to do with the congressman I send in my district? Because, you see, that is just violation of my rights. When people from other states pour money into some congressman's campaign and he winds up winning, when we have another guy here that's a local just as well, but he may be a better candidate, but other people from other states are making that decision. So that's one thing that I think that you should consider. And another one is you were talking about Roe versus Wade. Well, under our Constitution, one majority vote can override anything the Supreme Court rules. And it also can decide what case goes to the Supreme Court. And those two mechanisms is what I think a lot of us should focus on rather than going for this big, huge thing of trying to sweep both houses. I mean, I agree with sweeping all of them out of there, but you know what? That is more impossible today because of ignorance than anything else. But 3 million people can possibly throw the information out that, look, we want campaign finance reform, and if you're running for office in Texas, then you just get money from Texas and only $500, no matter if you're a corporation or an individual. It doesn't matter.
Have you read the petition yet?
No, but I was listening to it.
Okay, now let me read you what I've got on elections, and you know, I think you're probably right that it probably should have been limited to districts. I did not go that far. But on elections, I've got 3 points. One, that the Congress shall enact legislation which provides for fair access to all elections by removing any enactments, laws, or rules which give favor to any political party over another political party or individual seeking office, and that shall limit the fees required to such office not to exceed $1,000 for any state office and $5,000 for any federal office. And then I give the authority under Article 1, Section 4, Clause 1 of the Constitution, which gives the Congress the authority to enact certain laws regarding elections. Number 2, that the Congress shall prepare for presentation to the states of the Union an amendment to the Constitution which would provide for the states to repeal the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, and if they so desire, by ratification of said amendment, return to the state legislature the authority to select the senators of their choice. That would return states' rights. And number 3, that the Congress shall enact a law regarding campaign contributions which shall limit any contribution to a single candidate to $200, that contributions can be made only by citizens of the United States, and that corporations, political parties, and other organizations are not provided freedom of speech by the Constitution and are disqualified and subject to criminal penalties for any contributions or any activities which are intended to influence the outcome of any election. So I did not get in, as I said, I think you had a good idea of limiting the contributions to people that you could vote for. That's not there. But the rest of it, what do you think?
No, I like the latter part the most, you know, wiping out the corporations. That's a good idea. And just leave it to regular folk, you know, that vote. A corporation can't vote, you know.
Right.
So that's a good one. And limiting to the district is even better because that person is going to represent me.
Well, unfortunately, it's too late because when this went out, we can't change it because I'd hate for some attorney to say, which petition do you mean, this one or this one? So,
well,
unfortunately, we're past that point. And now it's something that could be pursued later on.
It's something everybody should consider that's listening right now, campaign finance reform. I mean, how much did the last presidency cost? I mean, look at that. How much did it cost for Ron Paul to go run for office, and how much does he have in his coffers? You know, I mean, these people are absolutely greedy. And I don't like calling Paul bad names, but, you know, you always have one guy, you know, that seems to talk the way you want him to hear. And, you know, because I haven't seen that guy do anything. He comes out and rants on C-SPAN. But what has he done? Now, if he's representing his district and they love the way he helps them, fine. But for Texas, I don't like it. I don't like it at all because he hasn't been able to recruit not one person that I know of. He might be able to say a bunch of names, throw names around, but I haven't seen anybody join him when he comes out on his little media spots. And you know, because I've gone to his political campaigns. And it was all about Paul and his family. It had nothing to do with me. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, now one other provision I think that you might like, that the Congress shall prepare for presentation to the States of the Union an amendment to the Constitution which would limit terms of office for all federal elected offices to a maximum of 2 terms, and with the exception of the President, shall have 1 intervening term out of office, which shall then be submitted to the States for their ratification.
Now, look,
so that would limit people to 2 terms, but require 1 intervening term. So a senator, for example, could serve 6 years in, then he'd have to serve 6 years out, and then he could serve 6 more in if the people wanted him. Do you
like it, and I don't like it. Okay, what I don't like is, like, say in your you're in a district, you got a congressman, and this guy is just batting for your district left and right. And then he's going to be limited, and you guys can't get him again. But I do understand that we cannot be having these politicians that retire from it. You know, that's just ludicrous.
How do you stop that without limiting terms?
Well, what
they do is they establish a chain of power. They establish their lobbyists, which would be eliminated by the petition as well. But they get their buddy system going, and there's just no stopping them because it's like gold. You know, when people get gold, the more gold they get, the greedier they get for more gold. Similarly, on power, the more power they get, the more greedy they get for power. If they had to go back down to wherever you're from for 6 years or 2 years if they're a representative and then could go back, they would represent you again, but you'd have the option at least at the end of the 2 years out of comparing him with the other guy. Okay, which one is best for me? Well, not the other guy because he has to sit out a year too. But we would stop that chain of power that exists in Congress now.
Didn't you state earlier that it should be the state legislature that picks these guys in the first place?
Well, the senators, that would be true, but then again, they would be required to be out too. Now, that would depend on the states ratifying a repeal of the 17th Amendment. The 17th Amendment was enacted in 1913 along with a lot of other bad laws like the 16th Amendment, the Income Tax Amendment, and the enactment of the Federal Reserve Act, which created the funny money we have today.
Originally, the state legislature picked their man and sent him to Washington.
Right.
All right. Originally.
Right.
Now, and that's what we should go back to for accountability.
Right. You look at all the states doing the sovereignty amendments now. They're doing sovereignty amendments because the Congress has run amok in enforcing mandates on the states. And the states aren't even represented. They're the members of the union by definition. In legal definitions, the states are the members of the union, but they don't have a vote because in 1916, that vote was taken away from the states, or that selection was taken away from the state, and they went to at-large by state. So the state is no longer represented in the body in which it's a member because they took the state's rights away by saying, you cannot select your senators anymore. We don't like the way you do it.
That's right. We need to get back to the Constitution. There's no doubt about it. Now, that happening, you know, some states came in by treaty, all right, like California. They came in by treaty. And then there's some nations that were taken by gunpoint. So, you know, there's going to have to be a compromise within the people, but not the Constitution. We should never compromise that. Every state has their own constitution or something like it. And, you know, every state should make their own moral decisions down to the community, down to the very county that you live in, because that's where your freedom lies, the county that you live in. You know, because you go anywhere else and, you know, the cops are always different and everything. But, you know, you go to your county and you expect to be living free. So you're only as free as your county allows you or you allow that county to allow you. So basically it comes down to each community and basically it comes down to each state making their own decision on some of these laws that are controversial. And federal funding, well, you know what? They're not supposed to be as large as they are. So we really have to look at this.
Well, I think if the states had their two senators sitting in the Senate, remember, every bill has to be approved by both the House and the Senate before it goes to the president. And so if the states were represented, the Senate more than likely would reject a lot of the enactments, especially those that have to do with federal mandates imposing on states. Now, I don't know if you know how federal mandates work. The one that got me interested was the Crime Control Act of 1994. I did a couple of articles on it. That was the one that had the cops on the street provision. And what they said is, one, we will provide the salaries for cops on the street in communities that need our assistance. And the first year, we will pay full salary. The second year, we will pay three-quarters salary. The third year, 50% of the salary. The fourth year, 25% of the salary. And the fifth year, you're on your own. However, don't worry, we will educate you on property forfeiture so that you can fund the department yourself. And then they went on to say that any department that accepts this offer is bound by the rules of the Justice Department. So all of a sudden, now the police departments are under the control of the Justice Department. The educational system, the same thing. If they want federal funds, and most states have given up funding schools to a great extent and allowed a lot of it to come from, most of it to come from federal dollars, and those federal dollars have rules attached. You shall not do this. That's why we have this problem with giving Christmas presents at Christmas that didn't exist. When I was a kid, hey, that was an exciting time of year. We all drew names from a hat or just got a boy or girl present and threw them in a box in the middle of the floor and took out one and got a Christmas present. But that isn't allowed now because the federal rules see that as an intrusion of religion, because it's Christmas, into our educational system. And this is where they've turned the Constitution upside down. What was acceptable for 200 years all of a sudden is unconstitutional. So if we get rid, if the states pick the senators, I think automatically we would see this. We've got, I think, 20 states now that have signed sovereignty resolutions. Back in the 90s, there were 27 states that signed sovereignty resolutions. Unfortunately, they do no good because those resolutions signed in the 90s are still in the books, and now they're signing new ones. That's how ineffective they've been. But if they had the power through the Senate to curtail the imposition of mandates on the states, that would solve the problem. And that's why the 17th Amendment should be at least offered to the states for repeal.
Well, we are talking and overlooking the most, two basic things. One is they're all corporations. That we got to get rid of, okay? If we don't attack that, nothing else is going to work. Remember, your foundation is what you stand on, and if it's sand, you'll sink in it. They're all corporations. We got to remove that. Second,
I hear a lot of arguments that they're all corporations and that's part of the evil. Interestingly, I'm not so sure if it is or not, but the first corporation that I'm aware of that was approved by the federal government was Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. Now, the Constitution specifically gave exclusive legislative jurisdiction to force magazines, arsenals, other needful buildings in 10 square miles. 10 miles square, and the land had to be ceded both for land and jurisdiction. Now, then Congress is sitting there, and are they going to act as the City Council of Washington? So instead, they set up a corporation and authorized that corporation to act as the City Council, because there was no other provision anywhere in the federal laws, and it was the easiest way to allow Washington, D.C. to administer its own city functions. I'm not so sure that the weight of corporations on that level is what they say it is. However, there is a provision in the petition that addresses corporations and puts severe limitations on them, and I'm not going to read it. You can go to the petition and look under legislation about the 6th item down and read about it. But once we curtail the authority of Congress, if any states don't fall into line, it's quite simple. We prepare a redress of grievances within that state, and the citizens of that state then sign that petition. In fact, Keith Broders and I discussed California about a month ago, shortly after I put this petition out. He said, can we do one in California? I think we'd be best to see if it's effective on the federal level, because the greatest evil comes from the federal government. But then if a state continues to operate in, say, I'm going to use the term loosely, a corporate function and abusively, you simply write what's necessary into your redress of grievances and submit it to the state.
Well, I didn't call to try and prove to you that they're corporations. I'm just going to talk to you at the level that you're at, and that is that we need to get Congress cleaned up. But number three problem is we need to get back to a paper ballot, because right now all the machines that are used to vote are owned and controlled by one corporation, and that's a fact.
Well,
now, I'm sure you're a knowledgeable guy. You should know that.
Yes,
you
I do. But I also
really
do
good points there.
You have to understand, though, that is not in federal jurisdiction. They can talk about certain things, and you know, I don't want to look it up right now. They're limited on what they can do regarding elections. They don't dictate that the machines be used. That's an option of the state. Now, whether federal rules, federal election commission or some agency gives the states money if they use those systems, that would be covered under the rules promulgated by the agencies being null and void. So, but see, that's a state decision. The state does those contracts. It's not a federal contract, so it's out of the purview of a petition of redress of grievances to Congress to address the method of voting. So
okay.
You understand, I mean, I'm concerned about it too. Years ago, I was county surveyor in Orange County, Florida. This is back in the 70s. And one of the jobs that I took on was rewriting the precinct district descriptions, the boundaries. They had to have legal descriptions, and they had to be drawn on a map. And me being a surveyor, the commissioner of elections asked me if I would, or director of elections asked me if I would write them, and I agreed to write them, and I got some volunteers from my survey staff to spend evenings working on them, and we got it done. But while I was working along that, she assigned a couple people from the election office to help me. One was the fellow that was in charge of the voting machines, and he and I had lunch together a couple times. We were talking once, and this is back in the 70s, and I'm sure they're more sophisticated now. I said, you know, these things are supposed to be foolproof. Could you rig the votes? And he said, I could have it take every fifth vote for A and give it to B. As sophisticated as these are, I can control the outcome to some degree. And he said, I wouldn't do it, but I know the means are there, and I know how to do it. So, yes, it's there. And whether he was lying to me and did it or not, I don't know. But on a county level, maybe not. But nowadays, as elections get more and more expensive, and I have no doubt that it occurs. The other problem we have beyond that, though, is what is the value? You know, they want us all to have chips, but if we all have chips in our arms, they're still going to let anybody register to vote 300 times. So we've got another problem, and it's called the election rolls. How do you prove that you are qualified to vote within that district? Something has to be done there, too.
Well, you know, we're in a mess. There's no doubt about it, and we got to start somewhere, right?
Right.
And I guess this movement that's going on, people are awake, and I knew this was going to happen years ago. People wouldn't listen to me 20 years ago when I was saying these very things. And, well, look, people need to get hurt and injured in order to wake up, and that is exactly what's happening, and we just saw the ball started rolling this year alone. And there's going to be a lot more.
Well, people have been injured and hurt and died already. I can probably list 40 or 50 people on the Patriot. No, I could list 150 or 160 people on the Patriot side that have died in the cause. Most of them were at Waco. Some were at Ruby Ridge. But there have been others that have died. You know, blood's been shed. Blood has been shed on the other side, too. Oklahoma City, for example.
I'm talking about masses of people. I'm not talking about...
you're right.
Like Bill Cooper. You remember Bill Cooper back in the 90s?
Yes, I know Bill Cooper, and I'd rather not discuss him on the air, if you don't mind. Bill Cooper has called me everything but white.
Well,
so,
I didn't know that. Okay.
Okay.
But
I would rather not say bad things about Bill Cooper, which means we need to leave him out of the conversation, if you don't mind. But
sure.
Let me say that you need to read the petition after we're done with the program tonight and see if it will be a damned good start at resolving the problems if Congress accepts it. Now, what happens if Congress doesn't accept it? And we have, say, 2 or 3 million people. 3 million people would be 1% of the population. It's probably more like 2 or 3% of the legal population. But if they reject it, pardon me?
County. That's where your freedom lies. There's where you start. You got to start at home.
Counties,
clean up home.
Counties are being, as I explained, counties are being paid by federal funds to abide by rules. They're not going to reject those funds because, especially right now, when the counties and states are desperate, they're facing bankruptcy. I'm in California, and this state, except for San Diego County, every county in this state is approaching bankruptcy. The state offered IOUs. The banks started rejecting those IOUs. Do you think the counties will give up that federal money flowing to them for abiding by their rules right now in the history of this country? I think you got another thing coming. They have a financial gun at their back. They cannot afford to lose one penny of the federal funds that are flowing in their direction. So starting at the county right now, is not swimming upstream. It's swimming up a waterfall, and you'll never make it to the top. Not in this current time.
Where do you think those funds are coming from?
I know where they come from. They steal them out of your pocket, and they probably skim 80% off before they come back down to the state because a study done in the late 80s indicated that 82% of the federal funds goes to the administration of those funds. That leaves 18% remaining to go back out and do the good. And that's how big federal bureaucracy is. Now,
but by definition, Federal Reserve notes are IOUs. We used to have silver certificate.
Well, that's
dollars.
That's addressed in the petition. Would you like me to read the provision?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Give me a second to find it. Banking. Stop all fractional reserve banking immediately. Do you know what fractional reserve banking is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's where the monetized everything.
That's where with $100 they can loan out about $900?
Exactly.
Okay, stop all fractional reserve banking immediately. Create no additional currency, prints Federal Reserve notes in prints for circulation. Begin planning for greenback, full faith and credit of the United States, without interest or surcharge, and gold or silver-based currency. Plan withdrawal from Federal Reserve Act to be accomplished within 5 years. Now, you can't just walk away from the Federal Reserve. We've got an economy that's built upon it, and there has to be a plan of withdrawal. But if no more Federal Reserve notes are printed, and we go back to greenback dollars, what Abraham Lincoln did, there's another word for that, and I think I got it corrected in the petition that's on the PDF file. And gold and silver certificates, there's got to be a period of time where you redeem your Federal Reserve notes for the gold and silver or greenbacks. Now, the beauty of greenbacks versus Federal Reserve notes is if $1 million comes out in Federal Reserve notes, the government is paying $110 million for those, roughly. And then the bank is loaning out about $1 billion based on that with the fractional banking system. Now, if the government issues $100 million worth of greenback dollars, those dollars are in circulation. They don't bear interest. And if you knew how much we're paying in interest every year out of the budget, it's phenomenal. So they don't bear interest. They go back to the government when people pay taxes, and the government then can eventually retire that excess currency in circulation by taking taxes. When they come back, the greenbacks come in, they tear them up and throw them away. They're no longer out in circulation. And eventually we can get back to intrinsic value currency based on gold, silver. They might even throw in platinum this time. Who knows? But there is a provision in there to begin. And it, like I say, it's too complex to deal with overnight, but there's a provision in the petition to remove us from Federal Reserve Bank within 5 years.
Well, you know, I have a totally different take on it, but I have to leave you right where you're at. I guess if I didn't know what I know, I would believe exactly what you think right there and go back to, you know, intrinsic value-based money. But you see, there is no money in this country.
Well, let me explain one of the problems, and I'm not sure of this or not, but I read an article that seemed to indicate that most of the gold out of Fort Knox was taken out of Fort Knox. Now, the government's not going to tell us if the gold's there or not, so it's either there or it's not there. If it's there, there is a means of conversion strictly to gold and silver certificates. If it's not there, there's not enough intrinsic value to distribute between the Federal Reserve notes in existence, which have to be bought back. Now, what we buy back, obviously the drug money, some guy comes up from Mexico with you know, $20 million in cash, we don't have to honor that, I don't think. We can deal with that, but we've got the debt to China, we've got the, which is phenomenal, and debt to other countries that are phenomenal.
Well, years ago,
I dealt with, and that's why it can't be an overnight situation from a practical standpoint, if you look into it.
Years ago, I read a white paper, which is done by some very knowledgeable people, very close, that Johnson wiped out Fort Knox back in his day.
That's what I'm talking about, and I don't know if it's true or not.
Well, the thing is, they don't let us see what's in there,
right?
At all. So, I mean, you know, it can only be true if they don't want to prove it's not true.
Well, right, and that's why what I've proposed allows for either provision. If there's enough gold in Fort Knox, then we can go to intrinsic value immediately. If there's not enough gold in Fort Knox, and we're strictly relying on what silver remains, which I have no idea how much that is, we've got to have an alternative for the transition, and that would be the greenback dollars.
Well, I like the
Treasury certificate is the term. Treasury certificates. They're issued by the Treasury, not by the Federal Reserve Bank. They don't bear interest, and they retire on return. In fact, our country was founded on that, but the provision for gold and silver-based currency for the payment of debt was the result of greed in the colonies by printing more and more money and not retiring it when they were supposed to. But it becomes an option, and it's how Abraham Lincoln avoided going to the banks to borrow money to fight the Civil War.
Right. And the law was changed in 1994, I believe it is Public Law 7310. And it's not a bad law if you look at it from outside the box. You know, we use credit, nothing but credit, our own credit, that was bonded on us a long time ago. I do not want to get into it with you guys because you guys don't believe it. But because if you did believe it, I'll tell you, you'd be talking about it right now.
Well,
and,
no, I've talked about with a lot of people about a lot of alternatives. Some people find one and they like it, so they believe it. But without tangible proof, I have trouble with that. But I've heard probably four or five solutions over the years. And I was traveling around the country talking to people all over the country for over 2 years. And I don't know what the best answer is. I'll be quite frank with you, because I don't know what exists. I don't like the idea of credit. One guy suggested that work is labor, and labor, we could use labor certificates. Well, I like intrinsic base value. I think that's the best assurance, because you can't create additional wealth with that, and you can oblige Congress to retire any Treasury certificates in a period of time.
I like the credit one. The credit one is a lot easier. It's a lot more controlled and accounted. And
no, credit is what we're living on now. In fact, that credit extends to my great-grandchildren. They have yet to be born, and they're going to have to work to pay off the debt that we've created this year and last year.
Not that kind of credit. That's negative, on the negative side of the ledger. I'm talking about the positive side of the ledger.
Well, Treasury certificates would be credit.
Well, see, the credit is used very loosely. I'm not talking about credit card type of debt. I'm talking about credit that we're all given by Public Law 7310, and you just need to understand what that means, read the law, and maybe you'll start talking about it on your program, and it'll be good. It'll be good. It'd be just as good as talking about this document you put together, because you see, it is the law, and our great grandparents allowed it to happen. Maybe they didn't pay attention. Maybe my grandparents.
Let me interrupt you. That would solve one problem and one problem only. The petition is attempting to address as many problems as possible in a single shot. That doesn't mean that afterwards we couldn't pursue other avenues. I will promise you that I'll read Public Law 7310 and find out what it says and look into it. Whether we have a program on it or not, I can't assure you. But we do have some other people, I think, that have some questions, so I think that we need to get on with them, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, you did raise some really good questions there, actually. That's why I let you guys keep talking, because you covered a lot of good things.
Well, I hope you think about the...
I muted him, but our other callers have dropped off in the meantime. So.
Okay, well, let's hope that you will support the petition by making copies and sending, forwarding emails and everything you can to get as many people. See if we can get 3 million people to submit these petitions in the next couple of weeks by Constitution Day, and see if we can at least begin a change that's not dealing with one single issue. You might find interesting, there's an article that I wrote a while back, and if you go to outpostoffreedom.com, there's a link to it right on the top. It's called Divide and Conquer, and it explains the problem that we have in trying to deal with dozens of problems at one time. So do we have any questions here on the we've got a lot of chat on there.
We're almost, we're pretty close to 2 hours. I think you covered pretty good. The main thing, why don't you give them out your web address again so they can find that.
Okay, the web address is www.outpost-of-freedom.com. The page for the petition, after that add a slash, and then you have tread on me, all one word, and a slash, and you will go directly to the petition. If you go to outpostoffreedom.com, you'll see a link to the petition right at the top of the page. I would like to explain what you have tread on me signifies. When I was trying to think of some, the program that we're talking about basically is called Under One Banner. It's trying to bring people in to collectively to act in more force than any of the single issues had, like this gentleman that just called in.
Right.
Under one banner, we can be a lot more effective than under dozens of banners. But the petition is the You Have Tread on Me petition. Now, the logo for that is a famous flag called the Gadsden flag, which had a coiled rattlesnake and a statement underneath, don't tread on me. My feeling, quite frankly, and apparently the feeling of everybody that's called in, is we have been stepped on. We have been tread upon. You have tread on me.
Right.
And now then we set forth the olive branch petition to see if there is a peaceful solution to resolve the problems that we all have with the government as it's operating today. Mm-hmm. So I invite you all to come to the webpage, look up the information, and if you would, please, send this out to everybody you know. They might delete it without even reading it. They might read it and delete it. But with even 10% of what you send out getting through, and then that going out to another dozen people and 10% getting through, it is very possible that we can get hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions of people to set these before Congress and know if Congress really has the intention of ignoring the people that created it or not.
Sure. Yeah,
so,
I think that's the main thing. They need to get over there to your website, get those petitions printed out. It doesn't take that much effort to deliver them, as you say. And that gets a whole bunch of them out there. Forward those emails out to their email list. Gives me people looking at it. And, you know, you should think about maybe going on, trying to get on the Alice Jones show or something like that. Maybe you can get that kind of go viral. I only got, you know, maybe 40,000 people listen to this show. It's Alex Jones. You might get a couple million.
Well, if Alex Jones invites me, I've sent – no, I haven't sent it to Alex Jones. I sent it to Glenn Beck and Hannity. I've sent it to another other places. I guess I need to look out for Alex Jones. I guess
InfoWars. It helps when you got a lot of people. And like I say, if he's willing to do a show on it, it might give you a little spot on there and a lot of people look into it, and that's good. The more people you get, the better it goes.
Well, let's take advantage of this opportunity. All you listening that are regulars at InfoWars, why don't you send some information about the petition onto Alex Jones, and let's see. I'll wait about 3 or 4 days, maybe till Thursday, and I'll get in touch with him and see if he wants to have me on the show there, and we can get the petition out in front of even more people.
Yeah, well,
I need your support to do it. I mean.
Yeah, if people are writing him, then that helps.
Yeah, I'll let you lay the groundwork. You be the artillery and soften the ground, and I'll contact him on Thursday and see if he's interested in having me on, and we'll see if we can get this to go viral. I would love to see it happen, but it can only happen with your participation. And
right.
I'll explain again what I explained at the beginning of the program. This is more grassroots than anything you've ever seen. I did write the petition, but once I released it and put it on the web page, it's out of my hands. I can speak for it. I can answer questions about it, but it's out of my hands. The petition will live or die depending on what you do with it. There is no organization behind the petition. There is no funding behind the petition, and there is no leadership behind the petition except you. So please become a leader. Get this out to the people that you know, and let's see if we can get Congress to realize that we've got some serious problems with them that have to be dealt with.
There you go. All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on, Gary, and if you need to come back and discuss it, any updates, just let me know.
I will do that, and I want to thank all the listeners for taking the time to listen. I hope you've learned something. I hope I've not offended anybody by anything I've said. But I speak from the heart, and I speak from many years of studying the problems with the petition. I tried to do the best that I could, and I only ask that you try and do the best that you can do now with it. Again, thank you for listening, and good night.
Yes, sir. I think you did a great show. We'll see you later. All right. So next week, probably won't be doing a show for a couple weeks. Got some personal items to take care of.
Are we off air now?
Yeah, you're off. Actually, I got a caller. After all this, I got a caller from, oops, I dropped off. Okay. So, at any rate, probably won't do a show for a couple weeks, but I appreciate everybody being here tonight. Did a good show. Appreciate everybody showing up in the chat room and keeping it going there, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks, and good night.